prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody off today with, nursing a really scratchy, squealy voice, worsened from yesterday. So Todd and I gave her the day off to get better. Hopefully she can be back tomorrow with Butch. For all your gold and silver needs, call us at 1-800-375-4188. Our next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Tuesday, July 25, 2023. Hello, Melody, wherever you're resting your voice, and happy National Wine and Cheese Day. I'm celebrating as we speak with a glass of my favorite Argentinian Cabernet Uname and some Bella Vitano raspberry cheese. Highly recommend both. And that's all I have to say about that, other than I hope for my own sake that there's some of both left when my wife gets home from work later today. Hey, let's go to today's market report. First, the precious metal markets. Gold off just a point or two from its high today of 1966, New York spot aftermarket. It's just shy of 1965. That's up about 10 bucks, half a percent. Silver up a percent and a third, 32 cents at 24.73. Platinum up just shy of a percent, 9 bucks at 977. And palladium up $9, 0.75% at 1,000. $324. Now, movement today in gold and silver, largely a function, I think, of a slightly fallen dollar. It's down 0.08 at 101.27. Other commodities, oils up about 85 cents at 79.59 a barrel. Natural gas up about a percent and a half at $2.73, or round it to. Silver, wheat, and copper also up in the commodity markets. Treasuries, not surprising here, 10-year yield up again. 0.027, yielding 3.88%. still seeing that significant inverted yield curve, 2 year at 4.87%. 91 day T-bill, 3 month up at five. Well, actually, that's down oh so slightly today at 5.44%. And paper markets. Dow Jones up a tad, 27 points roughly at 35,438. NASDAQ up 86 points, about 14,144 and change. And the S&P 500 up about 13 points, 4,567. And that will do it for today's market report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. A lot of different news going on today. Well, mostly. The first July economic data came out yesterday, and mainstream experts are saying it looks pretty good for the economy. There's growing confidence now that the nation can pull off a so-called soft landing that is bringing inflation under control without annihilating employment or GDP growth. The S&P Global Flash Purchasing Managers Index shows the services sectors continued to expand in July, although at a slightly slower rate than last month, and manufacturing continues to contract, albeit not quite as steep a drop as expected. Now, the fresh PMI numbers show the U.S. economy in a better light than many comparable countries, particularly Europe, which is suffering from a steep downturn in manufacturing, in part due to weak demand from China. And after this weekend, some say there's a new formula emerging in the U.S. economy. That is, Taylor Swift plus Barbie equals Goldilocks. Well, the ever-prescient Beyoncé should have been an economist. Her 2011 observation that it's girls who run the world is now showing up in microeconomic aggregates. New analysis suggests the blowout success of Swift's Eras Tour, combined with a record box office juice of the Barbie movie, which opened over the weekend opposite another hit, Oppenheimer, is helping to buoy the economy and actually prevent a recession. Well, we will see. A not-too-hot, not-too-cold economy, like the one we're seeing, of course, is known as a Goldilocks economy. Consumers are prioritizing experiences and entertainment now over buying things. They're scooping up Barbie tickets left and right and shelling out top dollar for tickets to Swift's Eras Tour, turning a one-night concert into a fabulous two- or three-day event. Yeah, it's interesting. The post-pandemic economy laid the ground for what some are calling Swiftonomics. That's the economic turbocharge that Taylor Swift's Eras Tour brings to each city she's performing in. The prevalence of hybrid work means that more folks are willing to travel out of town to see Swift and, well, book a longer stay. In fact, local consumer spending tied to the tour could go as high as $4.6 billion, according to Moody's Analytics. Now, Swift tourists aren't just spending on hotel rooms and merch. They're dining out, hiring designers, and hitting local musicians. Excuse me, museums, no pun intended. Of the 69 markets where Moody's tracks hotel performance, the ones that included a stop on the Eras Tour all posted an increase in revenue per available room from the same month last year. In fact, I believe her two-day concerts in the Philadelphia region, where I hail from, had a tremendous impact on the Philadelphia region. Some say approaching $40 million. Crazy. Meanwhile, Barbie's the biggest movie of the year so far, and nothing in the pipeline for the rest of the year is likely to top the $162 million it grossed at its opening weekend. It's also the biggest movie opening in history for a female director. Shares of Mattel maker of the iconic doll that serves as the movie's inspiration, have risen by 25% in the past month. Well, Beyoncé's new Renaissance tour just hit the U.S. this month, so it'll be interesting to see whether another economic boost shows up in that data. Some believe that the increased spending linked to her debut performances in Sweden may have caused an uptick in the country's inflation rate. No good deed goes unpunished, right? Look, the Federal Reserve's historic rate hikes haven't yet brought on a recession, and Americans are still spending what little is left of their pandemic savings, which we'll talk about later, and running up their credit card debt to record levels. Women who make up a big portion of the Barbie ticket buyers and Swift concert goers are also doing great right now. A record number of working-age women are employed today. In fact, the gender wage gap is at its narrowest point ever, and the widely predicted she session hasn't materialized, although we still have 6 months or 5 months left in the year. Well, girls do not, in fact, rule the world just yet anyway, but their influence in everything from culture to the economy is certainly the largest it's ever been. As Emily Peck of Axios said earlier today, forget the girl boss, well, except the boss of this company, Discount Gold and Silver Trading. This is the girl economy. Oh, come on, Barbie. Let's party. You go, girls. Overconfidence shot to the highest level in 2 years this month as inflationary pressures have eased and the American economy continues to show resilience in the face of dramatically higher interest rates. The Conference Board, you know, the business research group, said its consumer confidence index rose to 117 this month from a revised 110 in June. The gauge beat the 110.5 that economists had expected and was the highest since July of 2021. The index measures Americans' assessment of current economic conditions and their outlook over the next 6 months, and both improved in July. The future expectations index rose to 88.3 this month, clearing the recession threshold of 80 that was recorded in June. Economists closely monitor American spirits because, well, consumer spending accounts for almost 70% of economic activity here. The Conference Board Index fell more or less steadily from mid-2021 to mid-last year as surging prices primarily ate into household budgets. The confidence is coming back in fits and starts as inflation has eased over the past year and plus in the face of 10 interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve. Now, virtually 100% of Fed fund watchers believe policymakers will raise their benchmark rate again tomorrow by another 25 basis points to an upper range of 5.5%, the highest level in over two decades. The economy has proved surprisingly resilient in the face of sharply higher borrowing costs. Employers are hiring an average of 278,000 jobs a month so far this year. Falling inflation levels plus sturdy hiring have raised hopes that the economy just might pull off this so-called soft landing and avoid the dreaded economy-wide recession. Dana Peterson, who's the Conference Board's chief economist, says this likely reveals consumers' belief that labor market conditions will remain favorable. Well, we will certainly see, won't we? Well, the IMF believes that. It raised its growth forecast for the global economy today, turning slightly more positive despite slowing momentum in China. In the latest update to its World Economic Outlook, the IMF raised its 2023 global prediction by 0.2 percentage points to 3%. That's up from 2.8 in its April assessment. The IMF kept its 2024 growth forecast unchanged at 3%. Now, in terms of inflation, the fund also expects an improvement from last year. Headline inflation is projected to be 6.8% this year. That's down from 8.7% a year ago. However, core inflation, which of course strips out the volatile food and energy items is seen declining more slowly to 6% from 6.5% last year. The IMF said the global economy continues to gradually recover from the pandemic and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In the near term, signs of progress are undeniable. So says Pierre Oliver Gorenchas. He's the chief economist of the IMF, who adds, yet many challenges still cloud the horizon, and it's still too early to celebrate. The IMF highlighted concerns over tighter credit conditions, depleted household savings in the U.S., more on that later, and a shallower than expected economic recovery in China from the strict and extended COVID lockdowns. In the U.S., Gorenchas added, the excess savings from the pandemic-related transfers, which helped households weather the cost of living crisis and tighter credit conditions, are all but depleted. And in China, the recovery following the reopening of its economy shows signs of losing steam amid continued concerns about, well, the real estate sector, with implications for the entire global economy. The IMF projects the U.S. is set to grow just 1.8% this year and 1% next. In China, GDP is seen from falling from 5.2% this year to 4.5% next. Hey, remember when the U.S. government nearly ran out of cash during the recent debt ceiling standoff? Its bank account sank below $50 billion. For perspective, the Harvard endowment has more money than that. Now, one deluge of T-bill issuance later, that account, known as the Treasury General Account, excuse me, or TGA for short, is back up over, yes, $500 billion. Need to execute an unprecedented amount of Treasury issuance in just a few months was a byproduct of Washington's recent debt ceiling fight, which effectively froze Treasury issuance earlier this year. I mean, since the debt ceiling deal passed, however, the Treasury has raised about $600 billion by selling mainly short-term bills. It's likely going to raise another $400 billion by the end of the third quarter. That's the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, followed by another $300 billion or so during the fourth quarter. Money market mutual funds purchased about two-thirds of June's bill issuance, partly by shifting holdings out of overnight Fed reversed repurchase agreements. Eventually, the investment banks that also buy treasuries from the government and then sell them to investors will want to unload some of them to the open market, which could put further upward pressure on yields. And across the Atlantic and Mediterranean, for that matter, thousands of Israeli doctors walked out of work. Labor leaders threatened a general strike, and senior justices rushed home from a trip abroad today. It all comes a day after the Israeli government, the Knesset, approved a law weakening the country's Supreme Court that critics everywhere say will erode the system of checks and balances in that country. Four leading Israeli newspapers covered their entire front pages in black ink, an ominous image paid for by an alliance of high-tech companies. The only words on the pages were in a line at the bottom, in Hebrew, a black day for Israeli democracy. Now, yesterday's vote on the first of a series of measures that make up Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's divisive judicial overhaul reverberated across the nation. It came despite 7 months of fierce popular resistance, Netanyahu's promises of an eventual compromise, and a rare warning against the overhaul from Israel's closest ally, the U.S. of A. The bill was unanimously passed by the governing coalition, which includes ultra-nationalist and ultra-religious parties, after the opposition stormed out of the hall shouting shame. But opponents say they're not done fighting. Civil rights groups submitted petitions to the Supreme Court, the Israeli Supreme Court, calling for the new law to be overturned, and protests roiled the country's streets again today. Hundreds of thousands of people fanned out in Tel Aviv overnight, burning tires, setting off fireworks, and waving national flags. And hey, I was going to say, in Jerusalem, there's water cannons spraying foul-smelling liquid to clear the protesters. Another day, another drama, ladies and gentlemen. We're heading into a break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's off today resting her hurting vocal cords. But call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. Leave a message if we're on the other lines helping other customers. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. Or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com while you're there. Sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Again, dgscoins, one word, .com. Let's drill down on the Treasury issuances. Wall Street's ravenous appetite for government bills is about to be tested again as the Treasury is poised to ramp up the size of oncoming auctions to rebuild its decimated cash buffer. As we discussed in the first segment, in the wake of Washington's agreement last month to suspend the debt limit until after next year's elections, the U.S. Treasury has issued roughly $814 billion in securities in order to juice its cash balance. So far, investors have easily digested the first wave of supply, with money market funds absorbing about two-thirds by yanking $400 billion from the Fed's overnight reverse repurchase agreement program. Combined with the record amount sitting on the primary dealers' balance sheets, that's the 20-some major banks, too big to fails, are required, actually, to buy treasuries. It's allowed Treasury to sell so much paper without distorting the very front end of the yield curve, the short-term maturities. Yet, the cash balance is still below levels that are considered to be normal for this time of the government's fiscal year. And that's why analysts see the Treasury announcing a temporary cash management bill known as a CMB as early as this week to kick off another round of increases, followed by boosts to benchmark issues in the next 2 weeks. Treasury general count still running below seasonal norms due to the debt ceiling constraints earlier this year. Now, without the cash management bill, Treasury says its cash balance could drop back to the middle of the $400 to $500 billion range on August 1st and remain in that ballpark for much of the month. That's considered lower than usual. By comparison, the Treasury said last month it's expected its general account to decline in August before reaching its end of September goal of $600 billion. Wall Street strategists have cautioned that the influx of T-bill supply ultimately depends on whether investors can digest the last few hundred billions of dollars of the estimated $1.3 trillion of supply without it clogging up the dealers' balance sheets. The Treasury has telegraphed that it will increase the size of its coupon auctions at the upcoming quarterly refunding. But the next few meetings will be tougher to decipher because of various unknowns, like the actual levels of government appropriations to be approved by Congress. Another factor is how much government will need to raise to fund the Fed's ongoing balance sheet unwinding. In Washington, a bipartisan duo consisting of Republican Senator Rick Scott and Democratic Elizabeth Warren have asked for salary information from the Fed's inspector general. The IG serves as the Fed's internal watchdog. The senator's been criticizing that current system amid a push to make the IG role independent. Republicans and Democrats in Congress have pledged tighter oversight of banking regulators following the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature Banks earlier this year. The Fed's legally responsible for monitoring, inspecting, and examining banks and related financial institutions to ensure they comply with rules and regulations and that they operate in a safe and sound manner in the interests of taxpayers. Some in Congress are concerned that the Fed's current inspector general isn't independent enough to serve as a valid check on his colleagues. Unlike the Pentagon and other big federal agencies, the Fed's internal IG, whose name is Mark Bielek, reports directly to the Fed Board of Governors. Under the senator's plans, the holder of the role would instead be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, which I believe is a great idea, whose time has long come and gone. Now, among their concerns with the current system, the senators wrote in a letter, is that the IG's compensation is now structured in such a way to create potential conflicts of interest. Specifically, they object to having the IG salary tied to the compensation of Fed officials who the IG is tasked with investigating. Warren and Scott's letter warned, because the Fed Inspector General's salary is in part based on the bonuses earned by other Fed employees, there is a structural financial incentive for the IG to overlook or downplay wrongdoing by those Fed officials. They detailed five questions in their letter, including what salary Bielek had received over the last 5 years, what percentage of his salary was based on the average bonus component of the pay formula, and whether he had conducted any inspections in connection with bonuses at the Fed in that time period. Now, Bielek has previously faced criticism from Warren and other lawmakers for his handling of the securities trading scandal that caused two regional Fed bank presidents to step down in the fall of 2021. At a hearing in May of this year, Warren blasted him for failing yet to produce a report on a matter that tarred the Fed's reputation when it was reported just about 2 years ago. Bielek defended his agency's independence and ability to conduct investigations, saying, "No board chair has resisted or objected to our oversight work since I have been the IG." Certainly not surprised by that intrinsic self-serving comment. Well, no surprise here. We've talked about this recently. American politicians aren't the only ones working well into their 70s and beyond. increasingly people much older than the traditional retirement age of 62 to 65 are foregoing days on the golf course or volunteering at charity events or traveling and instead are staying at the office. In 2021, the Bureau of Labor Statistics published figures showing the number of people in the labor force who are 75 and older grew by 54% from 2010 to 2020 and is projected to grow 96% between 2020 and 2030. That's such a dramatic increase that this is the only age group projected to increase its share of the workforce from 8.9% in 2020 to 11.7% 10 years later. Now, a key reason behind the spike is that people are aging better than in the past. That's according to Jeffrey Sanzenbacher, an associate professor of economics and a research fellow with the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And that's the good news. Bad news is that many seniors don't have close to the retirement savings they thought they'd have by this point in their lives. That's especially the case for those who didn't have coveted jobs with defined benefit pensions or 401k matching programs. In fact, according to Congress's Joint Economic Committee, as of 2020, I believe, only 35% of Americans between 55 and 64 have a pension or retirement savings held in a 401k or IRA. Gosh, it's scary. To put it in perspective, the recommended savings for retirement is 6 times one current income at age 50. Meanwhile, the report says even among those Americans between 55 and 64 who do have retirement savings, the median account balance is just $88,000. And another factor motivating seniors to delay retirement is that the longer they work, the more they can collect when they start claiming Social Security. Every year you delay after your normal retirement date, which is basically close to 67 now, between 66 and 10 months, and 67, I think. Every year you delay until age 70, that's an 8% raise you're giving yourself forever. Working well past 65 is an option that's available to all seniors facing a retirement savings shortfall. That's according to a November 2022 report from the New School Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. That study shows that those who work at delivery, construction, janitorial, caregiving, nursing, and farming jobs are often not physically able to continue to work beyond traditional retirement age. Others might have to leave work to take on caregiving duties. Professionals with college degrees are better positioned to keep working. I can tell a story about my sister, whose name I won't reveal, but she's 65. And is a nurse in a psychiatric hospital. She's been assaulted so many times in her tenure there that, well, instead of working to her goal of 70, she's going to be retiring at the end of this year. In any event, the report's authors say policymakers should support higher quality jobs for older workers while also ensuring that those who are no longer able to work and retire with financial security. One solution proposed by Shavish Radport, the Schwartz's Center Retirement Equity Lab, would be for companies to open up opportunities for all older Americans to help them keep working. And again, in a related story, more mainstream analysts say the economy's held up remarkably well this year, defying recession predictions so far. Thanks in part, if not large part, to Americans' pandemic-era savings that have cushioned their spending. But that support is now running low. In fact, Americans' personal savings have collapsed by an eye-watering $5.5 trillion since April 2020, thanks to soaring inflation, and that could spell trouble for the economy when it runs out. Such reserves have now fallen to levels lower than before the pandemic. That's according to barchart.com. Household savings surged during the pandemic, spurred by government stimulus checks primarily, and a drop in consumer spending. While that cash pile has boosted consumer spending ever since the pandemic restrictions were relaxed, it's supporting the economy even as the Fed has raised interest rates by 5 percentage points since last spring. But historically high inflation since mid-2021 has eaten into the savings as prices of everything have surged. Inflation hit that 40-year high of 9.1% mid last year, but again has slowed to 3% as of last month, as measured by the CPI. Billionaire investor Bill Gross recently weighed in on falling consumer savings levels, warning that Americans could run out of their pandemic savings later this year, thus paving the way for a recession. Also adding pressure on the economy is the return of student loan bills, which, other things being equal, will also cut both consumer saving and spending levels. A new report by Oxford Economics forecasts consumer spending, in fact, could fall by more than $100 billion a year. Excuse me, as student loan payments kick in starting this fall, lifting the odds of an economic downturn. And one more related story. The average American, 65 years of age and older, earns an annual pre-tax income of roughly $55,300. That same group spends $52,000. $100 a year, or about $4,300 a month, or $4,300 a month. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, that income doesn't leave a lot of extra cash for unexpected expenses or emergencies. It comes out to about $3,200 a year, or $267 a month. Now, the average American who's 65 to 69 has about $200,000 in retirement savings, according to the Fed. And as we mentioned earlier, it may still need to work even when they reach retirement age. And high expenses often play a role. Now, experts say to watch these four categories that eat into monthly expenses. First, housing. Home costs represent the largest expense for retirees, accounting for 36% of their annual expenses. Retirees who want to gain a leg up may want to consider downsizing as house prices remain high. That could mean selling your current home for a profit, which leaves room to stash away more money for retirement, boost your emergency fund, or pay off debt. Second, transportation. If you aren't working as much or even at all, you might want to swap the car for public transit or a bicycle. Transportation is the second largest spending category, making up $7,100 in annual expenses for retirees. If your partner has a car, consider getting rid of one of the vehicles to cut costs. Even if you own your auto outright, car insurance, maintenance, and repair costs for two cars add up. Number three, there's healthcare. Health spending makes up another $7,000 in annual spending for retirees out of pocket. One way to cut costs when health issues arise is to get easily affordable preventive care. I mean, staying up to date on screenings and vaccinations, most of which are free. Exercise, including walking, also appears in the study after study as a top way to lower the risk of many diseases we face. And fourth, food. At just about $6,500, food expenditures account for over 12% of annual expenses for those 65 and over. Meal planning is one way to avoid overspending since it involves shopping for food items as opposed to regularly eating out, which can be an expensive habit. My wife every Sunday plans a menu for our dinners for the coming week, and we generally stick to it. And stick to your grocery list when you shop. I mean, other ways to save money on food include cutting down on portions or turning large portions at restaurants into a second meal you can take home and eat another day. And track your dining out to get an idea of how much you spend on items you could make yourself or just do without. even if you make modest changes in all these areas, you should see your retirement dollars go further over time. And in retirement, time is an especially precious commodity that more money can help you enjoy. And just briefly, well, I take that back. We're heading into our second break. I hope you'll stick around, listen to these important messages, and come back to us when financial survival returns.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. We're at 1-800-375-4188. Children from ultra-wealthy families, top 1%, are more than twice as likely to gain admission to Ivy League schools compared with others who have comparable test scores. That's according to a widely shared new working paper from a group of Harvard economists who studied inequality. Even as the U.S. Supreme Court just eliminated racial preference in college admissions, the new data show another kind of bias, that toward the very wealthiest applicants, who, oh, yeah, just so happen to be disproportionately white. In effect, the study shows these policies amount to an affirmative action for the children of the 1% whose parents earn more than $611,000 a year. The schools the researchers examined, the eight Ivy Leaguers plus Stanford, Duke, MIT, and the University of Chicago, graduate a disproportionate share of the country's business and political leaders. 12% of Fortune 500 CEOs went to an Ivy, as did a quarter of U.S. senators and 13% of the top one-tenth of 1% of wage earners. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, the rich seem to get richer at the expense of the rest of us everyday Americans. Look, I'm not a big fan of Elon Musk. He's done some impressive things, to be sure. But his bet the house against the odds gamble on Twitter is about to get substantially riskier with exponentially higher stakes. Musk is obsessed with killing the Twitter name and its reason for being and transforming it into a merger of a moneyless marketplace plus public square plus video content factory, his everything vision for an everything app. Fast forward the 1 year from today, Twitter will no longer be Twitter or even a simple platform for argument and information sharing. It'll simply be called X, a Musk-run social universe that pulls together 24 years of his ideas and wildest fantasies. In Musk's random musings, it will be Twitter plus Substack plus YouTube plus PayPal plus Amazon plus TikTok plus WeChat plus Baidu, all rolled into one universe marked by one letter, X. While Musk has been talking a good game about wanting to build new things on top of the old Twitter, in the 9 months he's run the place, he's done just too little of that. Journalist Walter Isaacson spent almost 3 years with Musk, sometimes for 12-hour stretches day after day, for a stunningly detailed book called Elon Musk, coming September 12th. Isaacson recently said that Musk has been plotting the X rebranding for more than 9 months, since before the signing of the paperwork to buy Twitter. Isaacson said he said it can be a trillion-dollar company easily. This is an idea he has thought about for 25 years, a financial platform that helps anyone profit from creating content. He added that Musk feels it can transform journalism by offering an alternative to subscription models where people can just make easy payments for whatever strikes their fancy. In Isaacson's book, he reports that Musk told him 2 weeks before taking over Twitter last October that he was going to change the name to X.com. Well, Musk has been obsessed with killing the bird logo since the day he first walked into Twitter's San Francisco headquarters with Isaacson in tow. Isaacson recalls when he first walked in, it was like a hard scrabble cowboy walking into a Starbucks. Conference rooms had names like Aviary, Tern, Bluebird, Canary, and Mallard. Musk told Isaacson, there are too many birds here. To many, the bird was witty and jaunty, a clever play on the company's name and function. To Musk, it was just a sign that employees weren't thinking big enough and didn't have a burning sense of mission. Isaacson describes Musk wandering the floors of his new company. He said he pulled all the woke T-shirts out of the cabinets and scoffed at the notion of psychologically safe workplaces. It was like watching a movie on fast forward. I could see him getting more and more frustrated with the culture. Musk told him, we have to replace this with a maniacal sense of urgency. So, on the first day of the X rebranding, the bird-themed conference room had already been renamed to Exposure, Exalt, and S3XY. Yes, life in the fast lane indeed, ladies and gentlemen. What would Tweety Bird say in a situation like this? I thought I saw a profitable company. Turns out that was a putty tat dressed up as Elon Musk. Hey, our latest American Survival newsletter is out in the streets. It features Doug Nolan's weekly credit bubble bulletin blog called Time for Resolve, Apothecary Herb's Wendy Wilson's Food for Thought column on birth control. Melody's financial market update recaps what happened last week, plus I have a piece that looks at two things in this week's Insight column. How last week's launch of the Fed's new FedNow instant payment system could save consumers a lot of money, and a look at how the potential economic impacts of artificial intelligence could outweigh increased job losses. First, AI. Felix Salmon tells us that artificial intelligence could have massive implications for economy-wide productivity, growth, incomes, inflation, and more. He believes that extensive embracing of generative AI could create a surge in productivity growth, as well as boosting income and overall economic growth. On the other hand, I say let's not forget about how it will undoubtedly disrupt individual companies and displace a lot of workers. Salmon writes, such a surge in productivity and growth would match the growth of the late 1990s from a wide range of tech advances and the profound effects of electrification in the early 20th century. He also points to improved worker productivity, referring to a study of a customer support center showing an average 14% gain in worker output per hour when assisted by an AI bot. The question is, how much and how fast will that gain scale to a systemic boost in the ability of companies to produce more goods and services compared to the quantity of work? In a Brookings Institution paper, Martin Neil Bailey, Eric Brynjolfsson, and Anton Koronek argue that AI could pay dividends in helping companies facilitate identifying productivity-enhancing strategies. Indeed, Salmon calculates if AI were to increase the productivity of labor using words, numbers, and ideas by, say, 30%, and such cognitive work accounts for 60% of all labor, productivity could increase by 18% over time. That's big. 30% times 60% equals 18%. Over a 10-year period, that would imply an extra 1.5 to 1.7 percentage points of productivity growth every year, more than double most current forecasts. And that would lead to proportionally higher GDP growth. Average income should rise, too, with winners, and that's according to Salmon, with winners and losers, as some jobs become more productive, while others, again, would be eliminated. Now, would increased productivity outweigh increased jobless claims? Certainly in the shorter term, they likely would, because virtually no new technologies pay productivity dividends overnight. Salmon, in fact, reminds us of economist Robert Solow's 1987 quip that you can see the computer age everywhere, but in the productivity statistics. It wasn't until the mid-90s that tech started to drive a productivity surge. Now, Brynjolfsson, who's a Stanford economist, argues that the AI-driven productivity revolution is currently more similar to 1995 than 1987. He says, quote, it's not in the laboratory, it's not just some technical benchmark, it's people really using it and changing the way they do business. He sees AI paying productivity dividends in the near future. Compared to the 1980s and 90s IT revolution, he says, this time I think the takeoff is going to be faster. And Salmon believes a future of productivity, GDP, and income growth would likely have profound effects on interest rate and inflation dynamics as well. However, too big to fail, J.P. Morgan chief economist Michael Feroli argues those effects could have the opposite effect. He noted, imagine your real income is expected to grow at a 2% rate and then something comes along so that you now expect it will grow at a 4% rate. In that scenario, Feroli believes most people would likely want to spend more today, but society can only spend today what is produced today. To maintain equilibrium, he adds, interest rates need to increase to reduce current desired demand. Well, as for inflation, when there's a supply shock, something that increases the productive capacity of the economy, it tends to exert a downward pull on inflation, at least in the short run. Thus, the economy can suddenly produce more while demand changes only slowly, theoretically keeping a lid on price increases. So, if AI turns out to be as big as many people think it could be, the experts say to look for higher growth, higher incomes, higher real interest rates, and lower inflation. And I say, good luck with that. In the meantime, let's do what a number of leading futurists have said, and let's put the brakes on until we decide some ethical issues. Hey, last Thursday's launch of the FedNow Instant Payment System marks the Fed's embrace of a model that's done well in other places around the world. Courtney Brown and Neil Irwin say if FedNow catches on in the U.S., the biggest losers are likely to be the major credit card issuers. Oh, poor too-big-to-fail banks. Brown and Irwin report that swipe fees paid by merchants when customers pay by credit card reached $100 billion last year. It's according to LendingTree, more than $800 per household. To encourage credit card usage, issuers give cash, miles, or other rewards to customers. In fact, BNI say the top six card issuers spent $67 billion on such activities last year. They point to a marketplace where most shops sell goods and services for the same cost, regardless of how they're paid for. Although it does seem, from personal experience, that more mom-and-pop shops, especially these days, are surcharging customers for credit card purchases. Well, BNI say it's entirely rational for consumers to pay with credit cards and then collect their kickbacks. On the other hand, they argue there's no good reason why this kind of financial intermediation should be a $100 billion industry, rife with inefficiencies. Art Seberg of TD Cowen says the shift to instant payments is inevitable, though it will take time. Well, FedNow, together with its private sector counterpart, RTP, is a behind-the-scenes technology. Eventually, BNI say it will be built into point-of-sale terminals so customers can buy things by transferring money instantly out of their checking account. But that's likely to take a little while longer. To get a feel for how fast instant payments can be adopted, they say to look at Brazil, of all places. That country's instant payment system, called PIX, P-I-X, was non-existent before the pandemic. Today, it comprises over 8 billion transactions a quarter. That's more than the next two highest payment methods, credit cards and debit cards, combined. Credit card transactions there have fallen by 20% in 1 year. Matera CEO Carlos Neto says PIX poses the greatest threat yet to credit card dominance because of how intuitive payments can be. But BNI say PIX isn't successful just because it's easy to use, but also because merchants are making it the default payment option and even offering discounts for customers who use it. And that's because the average PIX fee for businesses is just 33 basis points, 0.33%, compared to 2.34% for credit cards. As BNI assert, Americans love their credit cards, though not necessarily their $1.3 trillion in collective credit card debt, and we will be slow to give them up. They claim if merchants get aggressive in pushing us towards something akin to PIX, they could end up saving tens of billions of dollars in interchange fees that we consumers end up paying indirectly. The question then becomes, will these merchants pass those savings on to us? Definitely something worth following, ladies and gentlemen. As we end today's program, it's all the time we have. I'll be back on Thursday. Hopefully, Melody will be in shape to talk tomorrow with Butch and Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. In the meantime, thanks always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.